The mothership has landed, ladies and gentlemen, and Brother DA is back.
The mothership has connected. Welcome aboard.
No, that's a different show. You're listening to The Weekly Tour, and I'm telling you, we are so excited. It's August 19th, 2016, here from Peabody, Mass, one last time, the great state of Massachusetts, because soon, 5 days soon, we're off to New York. It's the podcast. It's the weekly tour of sports and pop culture. This is the show that uses safety scissors. We'll get to that later. So, welcome aboard. One last time here from Peabody. I want to thank you guys all so much for being aboard with us these last 11 weeks. It's been a fantastic summer. The outpouring of support from you guys for this podcast has been more than I could ever imagine. And we're just going to keep growing when we hit the great campus of Syracuse University. And speaking of Syracuse University, we have an absolute legend, one of the great alumni to ever walk the campus and grace the airways of Syracuse, New York, on our show today. And we'll get to him shortly, but first, a few updates from the life of Bobby Manning and a new location where you're going to be able to get some updates from my life, some fantastic stories I run into here or there, some of my thoughts on music, some of my thoughts on sports, and what I'll call long-form tweets, because we have a new website coming within the next week. RealBobManning.com, you heard it here, you heard it first. It is launching on September 1st, and we're going to be bringing you both my portfolio, all the things I write across all my platforms, Celtics Blog, Bosox Injection, CLNS Radio, the work I do over there, and here on the Bobcast. You're going to be able to get it all in one handy location. That's RealBobManning.com, and that's coming to you shortly. Also, as part of that site, we're going to have a new platform called The Journey. That's going to be my own blog, the long-form tweets I talked about, and that is just going to be a fantastic resource for me. We're going to bring some awesome content there to you. And like I said, everything I do, it's all about entertaining you guys. It's all about getting you guys the best information, the best stuff to brighten your day. And I want to hear your feedback. Let me know how this show is going. We're actually going to take a week off when we get out to Syracuse and just regroup, talk about the show, what can get better, what can improve going forward, anything else that needs to see improvement in my life, because we're getting started on a new job out there too, Syracuse Volleyball. No one is ever going to cover Syracuse Volleyball better than me, because that's the beat I'm going to be on first semester out there at Syracuse University, and luckily, they're pretty good. Last year, they were one of the better teams in the ACC, so I don't care what sport it is, there's good stories in any situation you can find yourself in, as long as the team is good. I'll tell you, I haven't experienced it yet, luckily, but there is nothing worse than covering an awful team. And that's what they got out there with that football team last year, so hopefully that's going to improve too, because I just bought my season tickets. Those weren't cheap. And hopefully we're going to get a good product with that new coach out there, Dino Babers. But I've talked enough about Syracuse. I've talked enough about RealBobManning.com, because we have a fantastic guest on our show today. I've teased him in the week leading up to the show, and we're going to give him the good old Bobcast introduction right after we shout out our good old friends at Loot Crate. As always, they're backing up our show. They are helping us out, and we're going to help them out by giving you a great deal on your Loot Crate subscription. What is Loot Crate? It is a box service. It's a nice care package coming your way every single month, full of the best gear in pop culture, summer blockbusters. They have it, and they are unique items. Here's a special deal for you, courtesy of CLNS Radio. You head over to lootcrate.com/CLNS and we're going to get you a deal on your first subscription. For less than $20 a month, you get 6 to 8 items that include licensed gear, apparel, collectibles, unique one-of-a-kind items, and more. And you have until the 19th of September. I'm telling you, you guys waited too long on this, because today is August 19th, as I said, to open up the show. So those boxes, those loot crates are heading out. You're going to have to wait until September 19th at 12 a.m., but you might as well get it early. Head over to lootcrate.com/CLNS and enter the code CLNS, and you're going to save $3 on your new subscription. And time to give our guest a warm Bobcast welcome, as we always do. 11 weeks ago, as you remember, we had Adam Coffin, one of our best guests on the Bobcast so far, a local media personality, the true heroes in sports media, because those guys hit the air every single day, bring content that drives you to work, drives you home, gets you to bed at night, as DA used to do with me, and I just leaked the secret. Damon Amendolar is with us on the show, and who is DA? If you don't know who he is, I don't know why you're listening to this show, because you should. He has his own Wikipedia page. That's when you know you've made it. And that helped me a lot with his intro right here. CBS National Radio host, The DA Show, from 6 to 10 p.m. every single weeknight. And as the people here in the Boston area know, he was formerly one of the originators at 98.5 The Sports Hub, the number one sports radio network in the area now, amazingly enough. When that started in 2009, it faced steep competition from WEEI and guys like DA, Felger and Maserati, the people on before him. All those guys got that station up to number one, and it's a big part of any Boston sports fan's experience now. Going forward, he graduated Syracuse in 2001. He worked at WBZ, did Revolution sideline work. That's our good old soccer team here that we love so much, even more than the Patriots. NFL Network appearances, NFL film documentaries, work at WFAN. He's a true New Yorker, and that's where he's back at now doing his national job, so I'm sure he's loving that. He also spent time in Fort Myers after Syracuse. He was in Kansas City for most of the 2000s. He's been all over the place, and we're going to talk to him about his journey here on the Bobcast today. The Mothership joins the weekly tour. Welcome aboard, DA. It is so fantastic to have you on. I can't even describe how excited I was to talk to you today.
Fired up to be here, Bobby. I'm glad that my Wikipedia page finally paid dividends.
Yeah, boosting the views over there.
I gotta
ask you, you've beamed up so many people in the Mothership over the years. Of all those people, this on the weekly tour, you've been the most exciting person I've talked to on here. And this is going to be a great interview we have. But right off the bat, who's the most exciting person you've gotten to talk to in all your years on the Mothership?
It's a great question. There's probably a couple of guys that I were excited to talk to. And they're usually former athletes, guys that are retired. And I could kind of go back and pick their brain about games that they've played, teams that they were on, because I think you get a different sense from guys that are retired, have that perspective, have some time away from the game and the stories that you get, versus guys that are currently in the game, currently employed, active players. So when I was in Boston and I got to talk to guys like Troy Brown or Andre Tippett, or Ty Law, that was always a thrill for me, because then I could really pick their brains on Bill Belichick, Tom Brady, playoff games, Super Bowls, et cetera, and get more of a context than I would have had they still been playing. I just spoke to T.O. last week, and while I find him to be kind of a self-absorbed, delusional narcissist, I really I kind of enjoyed it, because, again, he's retired, he's 5 years removed. And so you're prone to get some better answers out of guys that have already kind of walked away from the game and can reflect on their careers. I just spoke to Anthony Munoz a couple of weeks ago, and he's one of the great offensive linemen ever. And I really, really enjoyed it, because he's so smart. He's got a bunch of business interests outside of football. He's just a humanitarian and one of the greats of all time. And as you notice, I just named five football players. Football is the sport that's closest to my heart, growing up an NFL fan. So I have to say, kind of retired guys that give some context, you know, I've had both Daryl Strawberry and Doc Gooden on my show, and I grew up a huge Mets fan. I still am a Mets fan, and those were my guys. Those were my teams of the 80s. So that was really special to me. But again, it's almost always players, coaches, et cetera, that have already kind of disconnected, and I could kind of go back and pick through their careers with them.
D.A., do you mean to tell me that the players on the Patriots right now don't give it to you straightforward?
I'll tell you, it's the hardest locker room I've ever covered. And when I was at the Sports Hub, I'd make sure I was down in Foxborough every single week during the season and trying to, you know, pick guys' brains and see what's going on. And even off the record, they're not going to give you anything. And that's just the culture in Foxborough. You know, they're taught the moment they walk in. I'll never forget the days that the Patriots would pick up a free agent off the streets, oftentimes a rookie free agent. It was like fresh meat because we were hoping that those guys had not been indoctrinated or brainwashed yet. I remember the day that Danny Woodhead was signed, everybody crowded around his locker. And a lot of people, including myself, thought he was the son of another player, figuring he was certainly not a player. But then when we learned, oh, Woodhead is the guy that came across in this press release, it was gravitate to him and let's see if we can get some information out of him, because just maybe he hasn't been here long enough to really know. But look, it's worked, you know, and I think if the Patriots did not win a lot of football games, it would be frowned upon by the local media and the local fans. But as long as they win, they've got the last laugh and the upper hand and doing whatever they want.
It's so funny. I work across Celtics networks here, and in the same media network, you have the Patriots on one side who don't give you an ounce of anything. I mean, Bill Belichick last night talking about that scissors incident that we'll get to, didn't even want to mention it. He just comes right out and says, it was my decision to not play Tom tonight, as he does in his good old Belichick voice. And then on the Celtics side, Danny Ainge, Austin Ainge, Wick Grosbeck, all those guys, they'll give you anything. And that's been the big plus of working on the Celtics side of things. I can't even imagine having Bill Belichick here on the Bobcast. I'd be dropping him off in 3 minutes. There'd just be nothing to talk about. And here in the Boston Network, DA, we miss you so much. 6 to 10, 98.5, the Sports Hub. And I kind of want to talk to your journey about your journey to that point up in 2009 when the company got launched. You were in Syracuse University, where I'm headed so soon, so exciting this upcoming week. Then you're off to Fort Myers, Kansas City, so many different media networks. Way back when we talked to Adam Kaufman, who I feel like was in 13 states before he finally ended up in here in Boston. What was it like traveling all those different locations, and what was the most valuable experience on that road to finally ending up at 98.5?
Really good question. I found the whole trek to be really valuable because I'd grown up in New York, as you alluded to in the intro. I was a native of Warwick, New York, which is in the Hudson Valley, lower Hudson Valley, about an hour north of New York City, northwest. My family was from Brooklyn, and so I knew New York City well. I knew my area well, and I knew the New York sports teams well, but I didn't know what it took to kind of have to go into a different town and learn right away and be thrown to the deep end. And when I got to Syracuse, I really appreciated kind of the first day one of our professors telling a group of freshmen, hey, if you think you're going to walk out of here and go to NBC in New York, you're sadly mistaken. Get ready to go to a place you've never heard of and make no money and have to succeed there. And so I was prepped for that from an early time at SU, and I really always found that to be the most valuable thing they could teach you, to create different expectations. And so when I left Syracuse, or my senior year, I was working also part-time in Rochester, New York, doing stuff for a minor league soccer team, pregame and postgame for the Rochester Rhinos. I left for Fort Myers, Florida for my first full-time job and had to learn all of the Florida teams, Tampa and Miami, because it was right in between the two. And then my first job in a major market, I felt, was my Kansas City job. And when I was in Fort Myers, I was hired to do the night show in Kansas City for a startup, a sports radio station called 610 Sports. And a little bit like the Sports Hub, they were going up against the established competitor in town that had been there for years. And at that time, It was 810 WHB. So we, just like it was a parallel to my Sports Hub experience, I was hired to be a night show, maybe a little bit of a lighter side of sports, on a startup to go up against the behemoth in town. And that challenge was really important for me because, look, I had known the Chiefs, I had known the Royals, but I had no inner working knowledge of those franchises. So to be out there and to have the responsibility, hey, you're not from here, but you need to learn this now because the show is yours and we need to succeed, was a huge responsibility and something that I really took very seriously. So I was out at Chiefs practice and in meetings and press conferences all the time. I would try to go out to Kauffman Stadium as much as possible, even though the Royals were terrible. They were, you know, Kansas City is a huge college basketball and football town because Kansas University, K-State, and Mizzou are all within an hour and a half of there, and it's all alumni in Kansas City. So I had to kind of learn the history of all those programs as well, and that was really important because it forced me to be in a completely different area and learn about teams on an intimate basis that I had no real knowledge of. And from there, they promoted me to the morning show. I did a morning show there for about 4 years, then took a job in Miami, WQAM, and did the same thing. Had to kind of learn the Dolphins all over again and learn the Marlins and learn the Heat and learn the Panthers and University of Miami Hurricanes. And then that's in 2009 when they launched the Sports Hub and I got the call. I said, I absolutely want into the Sports Hub. It doesn't matter what time slot, doesn't matter what the salary I was in because – I had visited Boston a bunch when I was growing up. My cousin went to BU. He was actually on the dive team there on scholarship, and I visited him every semester. My brother went to Emerson, and I just always loved Boston as a sports town. And it was really close to coming back to the Northeast and my family in New York, and I was gravitated to Boston, and I said, I need to do this. I want to do this. I was really fortunate that came up. But by the time I got to Boston, I had dotted the map and kind of seen what the experience was of launching a station and learning about new teams and learning about a new area and trying to indoctrinate myself into that culture. And number two, I knew Boston way better than any of my other stops because of my experiences there growing up. So I was ready for that challenge, and the Sports Hub made it easy because we were really successful right from day one. So I was able to kind of ride the momentum of the entire station moving forward.
I love what you said about learning those new situations that you found yourself in all those years, because we here in the media really are expected to be experts in all these different teams we cover. And when you're traveling around to all these different places, you just find yourself seeing new, fresh faces every year. And that's something I got to get ready for on Syracuse, too, covering the volleyball team next year. And I think that's going to be a great, humbling experience because you got the Final Four team that made their run last year on national TV. You got the football team that's had its moments way back when, and they catch a lot of the fanfare up there. But some of those smaller teams, like the volleyball team, that have their success beneath the surface, I think it's going to be a great experience covering one of the smaller teams on campus like that. So back to the Sports Hub. It really was the great experiment back in 2009. WEEI was just this powerhouse for decades in the Boston area, and this new fresh station comes along with a few guys from in the area, a New York guy like yourself. It, not many people expected it to be able to fight with the big dog, but then eventually you guys took down the big show. WEEI is way behind 98.5 in the rankings now. And you had that fantastic mothership program, which is still running today except on the national scene. When did that whole show concept kind of come together during your journey? I mean, from the public service interlude intro, the coin toss out, the beaming up your collars, permission aboard, all that great stuff. It really was just such a fantastic production. And every night going to bed, all those years, I would tune your show on and just listen to some of the crazy callers you had, the guests you had on. It was just a whole experience, the show. When did that whole concept come together?
Well, you know, it's interesting because it was all layers. It didn't just come out of thin air, oh, let's do this and this will work this way.
It developed over time.
Yeah, it developed organically, which is when you know the stuff is the most effective.
Mm-hmm.
It was all different periods. When I was in Miami, I was listening to a lot of funk and Parliament Funkadelic in 70s. I'd always loved Motown and funk and old school hip hop growing up. And so Parliament Funkadelic was just one of my favorite bands. And they used to land, I mean, back in the 70s, a spaceship on stage. And they used to say, you know, the mothership has connected, welcome aboard. And they were really kind of out there with their references. And I love that. You know, that's kind of my sense of humor. That's kind of my personality, to be a little bit out there, a little bit out of left field. And I just always love that metaphor of inviting people into a spaceship to party. So when I got to Boston, I said, you know, I'm going to try this just as an opening line. You know, the mothership has connected, welcome aboard. I just, as a metaphor, hey, welcome to my party. And that's how I have always viewed sports radio, as you're inviting somebody into your home, into your house, into your party, into your garage, into the sports bar, and let's watch the game and let's talk about it. So I use that as a metaphor. It's interesting because then we started developing production around it. And so the production team, which was over there, which is awesome, and a guy by the name of Mark Feldman, who still works in Boston as a producer on one of the FM stations, is just one of the most genius audio guys I've ever been around, really loved the idea. And so I worked with him as we developed this kind of construction of a spaceship and spaceship sounds and the Jay-Z. And I knew that I wanted that as the song because I love the dramatic buildup. Mm-hmm. So we had this. And then we had this, and people started noticing that it was kind of quirky and it was kind of interesting. And there was never a permission to board. But as we developed this kind of spaceship mothership thing, one of our callers in Boston started saying, hey, permission to come aboard. And I would just say, permission granted.
That's awesome.
And it was just one caller, permission granted. And he called once a week or so. Then other callers started doing that. And so I said, gosh, this is hysterical. This is kind of catching on. Okay, so let's roll with it. And I've always said, if it's organic and it works, just roll with it, because that means that listeners are doing it themselves and it's a communal experience. And then the Mario coins became a whole different thing, because WEEI had kind of taken shots at our ratings as we started to surge. And it was fairly amazing. As you kind of alluded to, there was not a lot of expectations that we could win, let alone compete. And within the first book, within the first, I'll never forget it, I thought it would take us a few years to really get traction. Within the first ratings book, Felger and Maz had closed the gap to within points of the Big Show. And I said, whoa, if our anchor show can do this within one ratings book, this is astounding. And I think by the second book, they had beaten the Big Show, and then TNR was very close to DNC. And then, you know, within a calendar year, all of our time slots beat them. And that was just extraordinary. Now, we had the benefit of the Patriots broadcast and Bruins broadcast as the Bruins got good, but it was extraordinary. So EEI started taking shots at us publicly about our listenership, and it wasn't that their listenership wasn't being properly counted, because they had the AM AM signal, but then they also had the FM signal out of Providence, you might remember, and we were only on FM. So they started combining the ratings, you might remember, in like '09 and '10, and trying to battle our numbers in the Boston Globe and publicly. And so we started making fun, like, oh, how many ratings points or how many callers does each caller represent? If on EEI, one caller represents like three callers, I guess we'll also count these as three callers. So when we started doing that, we started kind of doling out Mario coins. And it was just like, oh, we've got, you know, John and Braintree. Okay, he's worth three listeners. So we just gave him like three Mario coins. And then John and Medford would call up and we gave him like 10 Mario coins. Yeah, John and Medford's a great caller. He's worth 10 listeners. And then that kind of spread to where every caller wanted to get a Mario coin as representative of a listener for a ratings point. Okay, so we started doing that. And then we started giving out so many of them that we could only – it sounded ridiculous. I mean, everybody was just getting hosts of Mario coins. And I'm just a big old-school Nintendo fan and Sega Genesis video game fan, so I love those old sound effects. So then we – we said, okay, if you're a new caller, first-time caller, you get the Mario coin. But we have to limit this because we can't give everybody the Mario coin. So
there were just so many listeners pouring in. You were going to run out of them at that point. So you mentioned the Bruins, and it's just bringing back so much nostalgia between your old show here and those fantastic Bruins teams from about 2008 through 2014. And luckily for you, you got out of here right as that whole organization's just starting to capsize now. These last 2 years have been so rough. But back in 2011, I was never the biggest Bruins fan. I mean, the three other teams in the market here supersede them by so much. But those teams were so good, had so much personality. Those playoff series every spring just pulled you in and captivated you to the maximum, especially in 2011 with the way Tim Thomas dominated throughout that run, one of the best goalie runs of all time. And then probably the best series of my lifetime was that 2011 Stanley Cup between any sport. In Game 7, so much uproar, so much leading up to that game. I mean, Vancouver had won all three games at home. Boston had dominated all three games here at the Garden. And then they go out there for a Game 7. Everybody's worried about how they were going to do in that game, losing three before there. And then they come out and absolutely dominate them. You had the Riots. You had the Bruins hoisting the cup on the road way out there on the West Coast. You had, get the duck boats ready, and all that. And then on top of that, the DA show went all night long. How did that come together? Was that something you planned doing, or did you just keep going and going and going and it never stopped?
You know, I said that getting that job in Kansas City was the most important job of my career because it taught me what I needed to do to be self-sufficient in an alien territory and be respected by people that had never heard me. By the other side, the most special moment of my career was that night we were on the air over after Game 7, because to that point we had built such an intimate kind of relationship with our listeners on the Sports Hub on my night show. And I really felt part of the city and part of the family, and I was really appreciative of that because I knew I was an outsider, and people embraced me and loved the show, and that meant so much. And the Bruins winning, I could see how much it meant to everybody, and I was so happy for the city and so happy for Bruins fans. Bruins fans have been kicked in the teeth for a long time.
Oh, awesome.
They had been dismissed by EEI. I know for years they had tried to call EEI with Bruins takes and laughed off of the air. We're not talking hockey. What are you? And so you're made to feel like a second-class citizen in your own town. Well, us at the Sports Hub had no pretense about being more important than the things that people wanted to talk about. And I think that was such a crucial part of our success. I absolutely believe to this day that Bruins fans helped us become number one as much as anything else in the city, because they drove interest in our station. It became, hey, the Sports Hub's talking Bruins. You got to listen. And I'll never forget, I used to host a hockey show, which was before Bruins games, and we would throw out a topic, and the phone lines would get lit, and people would be calling their friends. Hey, they're talking Bruins. It's the hockey show. It's the hockey show. They're talking Bruins. And that was so interesting. It was so organic as well. So when it came full circle, remember, the year before we were on the air at the Sports Hub, and that's when the Bruins cough up the 3-0 series lead to the Flyers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's maybe the lowest moment in Bruins franchise history. I mean, they became part of infamy by losing a 3-0 series lead. So for the following year, for them to do what they did in such emotional fashion and the series that they went through, and then, as you said, the drama, the Shakespeare, that the seven-game series against the Canucks where you had Nathan Horton injured.
The
you
had glove all on Bergeron. There were just so
the
many backstories.
Yeah. And then for them to do it and for them to hoist the cup and be crisscrossing the country, and after all of this emotion, the night before Game 7, or maybe it was after Game 6, whatever it was, I asked my producer, Chris Curtis, I said, and Josh Deering, I said, guys, if they win a Game 7, I don't think we can go off the air. What, we're going to go to national programming? I said, we're going to hand it over to JT the Brick or hand it over to whoever's doing our overnight to the national scene when the Bruins won the Stanley Cup. I go, I don't think we can do that. And they go, look, if you want to do it, I'm in. I said, look, I'm in. Let's ask the bosses. So I went to the program director, Mike Thomas. I said, Mike, I know we're only supposed to be on until midnight or 1, but if we win the cup, I think we got to stay on. And he goes, look, if you want to do it, more power to you. I'd love for you guys to do it. So I said, you know what? Let's do it. Now, I was at a viewing party down on Causeway Street, and we were watching Game 7 down there. Well, when Game 7 ends, I've got to do the post-game show. So I'm on the air on Causeway Street as the post-game celebration happens, and everybody's crying and laughing and hugging and cheering, and I just felt so good for Bruins fans and for the city of Boston. So I'm starting to do the post-game show, and I've got to get back to the studio because they're going to close this bar up at 2 a.m. or 3 a.m. I can't be there until 6 a.m. I can't run the show. So at around 1 a.m., I think, maybe 12:45, we hit a replay of the final 5 minutes of the game. So you can relive the final 5 minutes, and the chills go up everybody's spine. They're locked in. They want to hear it again. Dave Gosher, Bob Beard on the call.
It was such a great call.
Get the duck boats ready. After 39 long years, the cup is back home. The Bruins are 2011 Stanley Cup champions.
It's an amazing call. And during that time, I'm basically being police escorted out of Causeway through the barricades and out to a station van run by one of the street team members. I've got to hop in the van, and we've got to book it down Leo Birmingham Parkway all the way down to the station, which is a couple miles away, so that I'm on the air by the time that broadcast ends. I get in the studio. It's wrapping up by Gosher's final call or whatnot. We're listening to the final 5 minutes in the car, in the van, on the way there. And then I get into the studio, and I'm like, hey, the Bruins just won the cup. You know, we're just breaking it down. The phone lines are open. And I swear, we never had an open phone line from probably 11:30 p.m. until 6 a.m. when Toucher and Rich came on. It was jammed phone lines, and people just emoting, people just celebrating, people just crying. They were delirious, and it was as special as I'll ever be in the middle of my career, and people still talk about that to this day like you just did, and it makes me so thankful that we did it, and so I've got so much gratitude towards the city for allowing me to share that with them, because that wasn't my team, that was their team, but I got to be in the middle of it, and there's nothing that will ever top it in terms of being on the air at a moment when it was as special as it could possibly be.
Yeah, you're definitely somewhere above Alex Rodriguez in the list of New York guys that Boston people like. So it's such an awesome story because, like you said, you were traveling to all these different media markets just trying to establish yourself and become that outside guy that people love there. And in that moment with the Bruins and with the station's uprising, you really became a superstar here. And it was awesome to see. It was awesome to tune in every night. And really, when that date came around, when you finally announced, and it was a great culmination to your story, I think. You announced to Boston that you were heading home to New York City and you were starting your new DA show on CBS Sports Radio. What was it like? I mean, the city fell in love with you and your show had gotten so popular here and you had that opportunity to go home, New York City, where it all started for you. How conflicted were you between getting the national job and staying in Boston where you finally became beloved?
I had said once I got that job at the Sports Hub, I said, if this station worked and we don't go under, and I was pretty confident we were not because we had really good leadership owned by CBS. I had trusted the CBS brass. I had a relationship with them for a while. I said, this is the only job I'll ever be at unless New York comes calling because I wanted to be back in the Northeast. I wanted to be in a great sports town, and I was close enough to where I could drive to go see my parents on holidays and be around my family when I needed to be, and that was enough for me. And I said, if this works, I won't leave here except if New York comes calling. And I really meant that. And the success of the show, I still I get kind of shivers thinking about because it mattered to people, and that was the only thing I ever wanted in this career was that what I said or what I did mattered, and it parlayed itself into so many Yeah, it parlayed itself into so many other opportunities. I mean, it opened up doors for me at Comcast. I did a lot of stuff on TV. I got to do Patriots pregame and postgame on Comcast Sportsnet. It parlayed itself into the sideline gig, as you mentioned, for the New England Revolution. I'm a huge soccer fan, so to work on a broadcast, get to know those guys, work on a real television sports broadcast that covered games I had never done before, it had just opened up so many doors that I'll be forever thankful, and I wasn't going to leave unless it was New York. And even when this job came, I was conflicted because I didn't want to leave my listeners of the sports hub. It felt like family. The listeners did. It felt like family. But there were two things that factored in. Number one, I got to go back home, and with that, I got to be on a national stage, which was something that I said, if I had a chance to have a bigger audience and I could touch more people, that meant something. You know, I wasn't going back to New York to be on local. I got to go back to New York and be on national, and it was on the Sports Hub overnight. And so I still felt kind of part of the community in Boston. And number two, the reality was that the Sports Hub stayed there for 20 years. There might be no guarantee that I could have moved up in time slots. You know, Tutcher and Rich were a machine and still are. They just celebrated 10 years on the air in Boston. I knew that they weren't going anywhere, and I knew that Felger and Maz were a total machine ratings-wise, and they weren't going anywhere.
Oh, absolute powerhouse.
Yeah, and I love those guys. And so, you know, usually you kind of measure yourself within the hierarchy of the station that you're at. And, you know, while the midday show with Gresh and Zoe did end up breaking up, at the time that I left, there were no signs that that was ever going to change and that those guys were doing great ratings-wise, so they were going to be there. So I looked at my future, and while I loved the night show, I said, this could be the lineup for the Sports Hub in 2040. I mean, there's no guarantee. I had to think about that because, you know, in the radio business, better time slots mean you are making better money, you have better ratings bonuses, you have more listenership. And remember, at that time, you know, I'm getting preempted for Bruins games or nighttime Patriots games. Then they added the Celtics. So, you know, like now, Keith and Jones, who do awesome jobs and they're total friends of mine, you know, sometimes they have weeks they're only on twice a week or whatnot. So that's far from a consistency standpoint. So the reality was I was always going to be low man of the totem pole in that lineup, and I had a chance to go home and be on a national stage and be part of the Sports Hub. In a lot of ways, it was no-brainer. The only part was emotionally it was hard to leave. I just – every time I left any of these spots – actually, I shouldn't say that. There were twice that I felt like it was hard to leave, Kansas City and then Boston, because I was such – a part of the fabric and the community. And emotionally, it's just hard for me to up and leave on people. It's not my temperament. I'm a loyal guy. I'm a grateful guy. And I felt like the relationship we had with the listeners in Boston, I was kind of skipping out, and I didn't want it to feel that way. So that's why, since we were on still in the Sports Hub, it meant a lot. I felt like it was a transition, and I thought that, okay, at least you could still listen to me if you were up really late at night listening to the Sports Hub. But that was emotionally hard. I didn't want to feel like I was skipping out on town for people that had given me so much.
It was just a great ending to your time here. You had that final episode. I remember listening to that. It was an emotional experience, and it really culminated a great time for you here in the Boston area. And I feel like a lot of people here still listen to that national show and still got a lot of love for you, DA. And I really appreciate you coming on here on my show and sharing some of your great knowledge through the years with me. And one thing I know very early in my career that I love to do is look up to the greats in the industry, the people who have done things well, and take and draw from those people. You work in an environment where you're around so many outstanding media members yourself. I mean, like you said, Felger and Maserati were on right before you came in. And those guys are so great. I mean, they're portrayed as kind of villains on the air here in the Boston area now for some of their hot takes and stuff like that. But, I mean, I've met them in person. They're outstanding guys. And the highlight of my media career, I can say right now so far, is Felger read one of my articles off Celtics blog on the air while they were talking about the lead-up to the NBA lottery this spring. And I still really want to get in there and thank them for that, because that was just so awesome. And Tutcher and Rich, 10 years, like you said, dominating the radio airwaves here in Boston. Another guy you work with now in New York City who is an absolute maniac, one of the best shows I've ever listened to on the air, Pharrell on the Bench on After You. That guy is absolutely something else. How much do you draw from the people around you and listen to their shows and take some things from them while you're trying to improve on your own show yourself? And on top of that, what I was going to ask you too is, what's it take to be a great radio host and captivate listeners like you have?
Well, who knows, who knows how you can kind of grade yourself, but I appreciate you saying that. I don't know if I would consider myself great, but I would say that I try to be as open and flexible and like a sponge as I can when it comes to our industry. I think that a lot of sports talk can be lazy, and a lot of sports talk can be simply, you know, open up the phones and just open up the newspaper or whatever, open up whatever is on ESPN.com and just start reading and filling time. And all the guys you mentioned don't do that. All the guys that you mentioned treat every show like it's a project. And I think Tutcher and Rich do this in an amazing way. It's not one thing they talk about for a day. It's 10 things, and it's bits, and it's Man on the Street stuff, and it's Adolfo, and it's songs, and that's a lot of work.
98 Mile.
Yeah, it's a lot of work, and it takes creativity. Felger and Maz, they think about that show. Felger's always thinking. He's always looking at other angles, and it made him different. It made that show stand out, and I always listened to them when I was in Boston, because I could glean something that I could use on my show following them. I could use something said, I could use an angle, I could use a sound bite that I could build the show around. And Pharrell is amazing because, again, he brings stuff to the table that nobody can. Who winds themselves up like Pharrell does?
He is
and
amazing.
Just goes a mile a minute. Yeah, he's like one of those wind up chattering teeth. He's just, and he's the greatest guy off the air, right? So much respect, because he really is a legend in this industry. He is one of the godfathers of this industry. I think him and Jim Rome are the two kind of pontiffs, if you will. And let me tell you, Pharrell has never been nice. He couldn't be nicer to me, and he couldn't have treated me with more respect when I came in and started. And, you know, compared to him, I was a nobody, and he has always been amazing and supportive and everything. So I do look at those guys, and I try to glean stuff off them. And you know, it's in terms of, I think, doing this well, it is looking at every show as a project. It's almost like it's writing a column. Again, a lot of sports talk guys don't really think about the show. They just go into the studio, open up the phones, and just kind of off the top of their head. It's about so much more than that if you want to be great in this industry. It's about thinking about different angles. It's about always creating something out of nothing, because you're given a blank canvas, and you've got to fill it. And so all those guys you mentioned do it remarkably well, and I think the best thing you can do in this industry is listen. Listen to other shows. Listen to listeners. Listen to emails. Listen to sports television. Listen to columnists. Listen instead of just talk, because those that just talk become really boring and in their own little world. Those that listen to everything and bring that in will be able to, I think, connect with an audience in a better way. You know, how do you have an engaging conversation with somebody? You have to listen to their side as well. And the great ones in this industry, I think, do that.
Fantastic conversation rolling along with our great, great guest here in episode 11 of the Bobcast. DA, we're going to roll into some content with you. We might as well hit on to the few things going on here in August to pretty much close up the show, because I don't know about you, but I'm having so much fun right now, DA. And it's great advice for me as I begin my career, too. That listening aspect is a thing I've heard a lot, and it's been great listening to you here today. So the Olympics. The Olympics have been a constant theme here on the Bobcast. I mean, it's pretty much written itself, the material. And I even have a top 10 list as that closing ceremony comes here on Friday. So with all the controversy and all the unbelievable accomplishments, I mean, we saw a 43-400 out there. We've seen Usain Bolt pretty much in his own frame running these sprinting events. I mean, the basketball team has even found a way to be captivating through some of their struggles. And they're on against Spain later today, so that's going to be interesting to watch. Well, I'm going to ask you, what's the Olympics' role as a major sporting event compared to the four major sports leagues here in America that were so captivating? How much do you think they really matter to America and even other countries that are involved?
It's hard to say what it means for other countries. I think for Americans, it means a lot in the moment. For these 2 weeks, all of these things seem to matter. I think outside of these 2 weeks, it never matters. But the Olympics kind of carry a very interesting role in our sports society, because even though they don't matter for 3 years and 50 weeks, they actually, in this moment, is what everybody's talking about and emotionally invested in. So while it seems silly to be breaking down archery or beach volleyball or the 4x100, it does mean a lot to people. And I think why is because these athletes are so not part of our normal athletic landscape. You know, you watch the NBA, the NFL, Major League Baseball, the NHL. These guys have been in front of a microphone forever. You know, they're always giving answers in press conferences. It's so startling and jarring when you watch these Olympic athletes and they don't really know how to answer questions. They never do interviews. You know, nobody ever asks them questions outside of these 2 weeks once every 4 years. You know, we look at amateurism in college basketball or college football, et cetera, but again, those guys are doing interviews with websites and being tracked on a daily basis via social media when they're in high school being recruited. Heck, sometimes coming out of junior high, going into high school. While all of these athletes we're watching outside of the NBA and WNBA players in basketball are never there's never a spotlight on them outside of a very small, maybe niche audience for gymnastics or, you know, cycling or something like that. So I find it really refreshing. I think while the Olympics themselves can feel bloated and corporate at times, the athletes themselves strip it down to really just sports. Because, again, do we really care about kayaking? Do we really care about some of these events? No. But the people and the stories and the sheer competition of it does draw us in. And then there are guys like Usain Bolt where, again, we won't talk about him for 4 years, but for these moments, it's must-see television. I'm waiting with bated breath to see what Bolt does. I was the same way with Michael Phelps and his races. I was the same way watching the women's gymnastics team. These are kind of must-see moments and events that, even if we don't talk about those sports ever, for those brief moments, it's captivating.
And we throw the term around legends so much in our own sports sphere here in America. I mean, we'll talk about LeBron James and throw that label on him, Michael Jordan, those kind of guys. But these are people we see year in and year out. They show up to training camp. They come through the season, do their unbelievable things, shoot through the playoffs. They hoist the trophy at the end of the year. But when you really break down what the meaning of the term legend is, I mean, there's sort of like a mysterious feel to it. And I think it describes some of these Olympic athletes so well, like you said, in a Usain Bolt, where he's in the shadows for 4 years, just breaking his ass, going as hard as he can, training and training week in and week out, month after month for 3 years. And then finally we get this little 2 week window where he's in front of the world, captivating the audience, inspiring his country. And that's a guy we're going to talk about for years and years. I mean, even well past his retirement for some of the outstanding things he did. So when it comes to the term legends, I think that's what really the Olympics are all about. Some of these little moments in the spotlight, it has sort of a 15 seconds of fame aspect to it too, because there are certain people, unlike a Bolt, that we're never going to hear from again, but they had their moment here, they had their moment that's going to carry with them forever. So beyond the sanctimony and, like you said, the business aspect of it, there really is something special about the Olympics, and there is a reason we all tune in every 4 years. But outside of the arena, it has been a total up and down mess. And I'm going to run through my top 10 list real quick right here. And I'm going to have you pick your favorite off this list, because there's been no shortage of material for my show here. So it opened up with the governor himself calling the Olympics a likely disaster or even a calamity. The governor himself in charge of Rio. Then public servants walking off the jobs for not getting paid. Banners flying, Rio is not safe and welcome to hell. From there, Zika virus, the prevalence of that. Paul Gasol saying he was going to freeze his sperm. And then some research firm comes out and says, oh, no, Zika's not a concern. You're more likely to get raped or shot in Brazil than you are to get Zika. Body parts washing up on the beach a week later. They killed a jaguar near the Olympic torch a day after a protester dumped a bucket of water on it. So then finally Rio comes out and says, nothing else is going to happen. Everything else is going to be fine. Then we hear about super bacteria in the water, pretty much filling the bay where they're going to be sailing their boats, or as you could also call it, the toilet out there in Brazil. The Russian doping scandal where the WADA comes out and says there's no good reason to believe that not every single Russian athlete is doping. And then the IOC says, come on in anyway, to the Russian team. Finally, the Olympics get started. You think everything's going fine. And you have a green pool and an official saying that chemistry is not an exact science. And then finally, we're getting all these outstanding athletic achievements, the great stories coming through, and Michael Phelps winning his 28th medal, and the guy in his shadow, Ryan Lochte, rocks the whole entire landscape coming out. And the quotes from him were astounding in his fake story. I mean, he says, we got pulled over in the taxi, and these guys came out with a badge, a police badge. No lights, no nothing, just a police badge, and pulled us over. They pulled out their guns. They told us, the other swimmers, to get down on the ground. They got down on the ground. I refused. I was like, we didn't do anything wrong, so I'm not getting down on the ground. And then he says, whatever, after they put the gun to his forehead. Such an elaborate story. I love how he makes himself out to be the hero. I mean, he's living in the shadow of Michael Phelps, so he draws up this heroic story of him standing up to these Brazilian gangsters. And then in the last 24 hours, the story is absolutely fake. You have him bolting to the United States and his friends getting slammed in Brazil. So I don't know how it can't be the Lochte story, but what do you think of all the off the track, if you will, antics going down on there in Rio?
To me, the most amazing thing is that Ryan Lochte didn't get robbed, but it seems like all of the other athletes from all the other countries have. You know, he was the one that was lying, but we have a British track and field star. We have a couple of Australian athletes. We have a couple of other athletes before the games that have been robbed at gunpoint. So it's not like it's been safe. This has happened to other athletes. The problem is everybody was robbed except for Ryan Lochte. Most remarkable story of this, and it's what we're going to remember for years to come out of this. But I think the shocking thing also is I thought that the venues were going to be so much more of a disaster, as you kind of mentioned there, but they actually have not been. I mean, I thought it was going to be a natural kind of disaster every time that they went into the water or onto the beaches, but I guess that was a little bit overblown.
Yeah, and on episode 10, I was kind of running my mouth talking about some of the stupid events they have there. I mean, between these guys doing archery, staring each other down with their game faces, and some weird event I never even heard of where two guys are in like a little canoe trying to steer between these little goalposts. But after a trip to Gillette last night and experiencing the marvel that is preseason football, I'll take it all back. Give me the two guys rowing in the boat through the goalpost any day over watching Jacoby Brissett toss against the Bears' second-team defense. And really the most compelling story last night was Tom Brady. We're all getting ready for Tom Brady. Tom Brady was the talk leading up to the game because he gets the start. And then all of a sudden, right at Gillette Stadium, he walks scissors. He was trying to cut something off of his cleat, I guess, with scissors. He gets stitched up. I'm going to call my own conspiracy theory here, because that closing ceremony down in Brazil is Sunday. It's a Thursday night. You know, I think we'll see, but I think, you know, Brady might have flipped the scissors a little bit, got a little slash on his finger, and said, you know, Bill, it's the preseason. Give it a Jimmy G. I got my four-week vacation anyway. So with the Tom Brady Scissorgate incident about to take a life of its own, what's the weirdest injury you've ever seen in all your years around sports?
Well, I think it's got to be one of those injuries that have happened in spring training where, like, a guy trips over his cat coming down the stairs or slips, walking out of his backyard.
It's always baseball,
sleeps on his neck the wrong way. You know, it's always something in spring training where these guys' bodies are not ready for the grind, and then somewhere in March, something totally ridiculous happens, and they have to miss, you know, the first couple of months of the season. I guess there was also, was it Howie Kendrick? Now, I don't know who it was, who blew out his ACL when he jumped on home plate after a home run, and he was gone for the season. I have to go back and see.
Yeah, I think that might have been Kendrick.
That was a pretty remarkable one as well. You got to love stupid sports injuries.
Yeah, and we've pretty much had a deal with Pablo Sandoval missing the entire season here in Boston with a big stomach. That's pretty much the diagnosis right there. So
yeah, bloated stomach.
So we have a few more questions from the listeners here, and we're going to send you on your way. It's been a great episode, and like I said, DA, you've been a great inspiration for me as I head off to Syracuse this week, Wednesday, and start my own journey. You and Adam Kaufman, really, and your journey through Syracuse and on have been a big inspiration for me in getting started early in my own media career. And I want to thank you again for being on this program. This was just such a great way to close our 11 weeks here in Peabody, Boston, before we head out on our way to New York and get the show going there. So we're going to hit some of these questions real quick, and we'll get you on your way as you get ready for your show tonight. So someone asked, what's the biggest regret of your career? Do you have any big regret from your career so far?
Oh, boy. I'm not a guy that usually lives with regret. I feel like every day of your career, every day of your life is kind of a new adventure, and you have to kind of just navigate that adventure every day the best that you can. Probably if I regretted anything, I don't know. I don't have many regrets. If I would do something differently, I don't know. You know, I feel like I've been really fortunate to live out my dream, and I take it seriously every single day, and I never kind of take it for granted. So I think when you keep those things in mind, you usually are pretty happy with your decisions. I mean, look, have I had a perfect show every night? Absolutely not. I can't think of a specific, but I certainly, when I was younger, I was a guy who wore his heart on his sleeve and talked a mile a minute and would throw grenades and, you know, probably got myself into a little bit of trouble because I didn't think before I spoke when I was a young guy. There was a few rants that I had when I was a young broadcaster in Fort Myers or Kansas City that were probably ill-timed or insensitive or something like that. But, you know, when you're young and you have this platform, you're expected to be opinionated. Sometimes you don't think and you yell and you just kind of rant. So there's probably a few rants that I would have tempered, had I had some perspective and context. But I can't think of a specific thing that I would take back.
I was going to say, rather than regrets, I think mistakes are a big thing we can really pull from and build off of. And like you said right there, improved upon those things. And that's something I always try to do is just get out there and make mistakes. And now's the time to do it pretty much before I get into the get onto the big stage there in Syracuse. So we'll move on. We talked about Pharrell already, but the other part of this question was, what's your usual routine after a show wraps up late at night?
Well, when I do my normal show, which runs 6 to 10 on CBS Sports Radio, at 10 o'clock we kind of get together, me and the staff, and we just kind of go over how we want to publish the podcast of the show, how we want to label it, what we want to download. Also on CBS, all of our interviews have write-ups done by the digital team, so we need to decide, you know, what was the best thing that our interviewer or interviewee said, and what do we want to highlight and have written up, because you obviously don't transcribe a full 10-minute interview. So we kind of go over that because at the end of the night, it'll be published the next day or that night for our podcast listeners that download or listen on demand. So we do that, and then I take about a half hour or so afterwards to kind of sift through some of the better stuff that we did or memorable stuff, and I make sure that they're saved as drops in the archives so I can go back to them and use them as sound bites, or we post some clips on SoundCloud as well so that people have kind of shorter bite-sized pieces of the show. And then at about 10:30, 10:45, wrap up, and it's like, all right, guys, we'll see you tomorrow. And the thing is that the show, it's never about you punch in, you punch out. The show lives with you, you know. So you go home and you start watching highlights or late games or whatever, catching up on what you may have missed as we were on the air, and you got to keep one eye on the TV, but one eye you're doing the show. And then you wake up the next day, and the whole process starts over again, and my producer and I connect via text message in the morning, and then we shoot emails back and forth. Miraz and I, who's a tremendous producer, we kind of shoot emails and kind of go over the guest schedule and shoot emails. So he sends me a topic list during the day, and we kind of go over what we want to lead with, the cold open. So the process is kind of ongoing. You know, when I come back at night, sometimes I'm a little wound up, so I can't go to bed right away. So I watch some TV, read a little bit, and then usually crash. And again, the cycle starts the whole way again the next day.
There's a lot of sleepless nights in media. I'll second you on that one. And another thing I wanted to talk to you about was your charity work. I mean, researching you going on this show, I always do the full 100 yards on my guests, give them the nice Bobcast welcome. And one of the astounding things I found out about you beneath the surface is you've raised tens of thousands of dollars through your career for charity. I mean, how did that end up starting, and how have you been able to help people through your career in that way?
Well, I think all of us that have a platform and a voice and a phone have a responsibility socially to give other people voices, or at least use our platform to help other people. And it's something that I've always felt really strongly about, something that probably my parents kind of gave me early on. But, you know, every stop that I've been, being part of the community, I think means giving back to the community. You know, when I moved out to Kansas City, they embraced me, and I was part of that city. And so I felt it was important to use that to give back to the Boys and Girls Club there and to raise money for programs out there, to do fundraisers, to buy kids in the children's hospital their toys, et cetera. When I was in Boston, you know, I was really fortunate to be connected with the Room to Dream Foundation, which overhauls young children or children who have terminal illnesses, and they are confined to their rooms a lot, you know. And because I had a stage and a platform, they reached out to me and said, you know, we hear your show, we love it, wondering if you'd just like to, you know, give a shout out. And I researched it and met the people there, and I thought they were doing such an amazing thing. I wanted to be part of it, so I got to be a board member and raise some interest for that. And they're going to have a fundraiser actually coming up here in September that Dave Gosch was part of, which is awesome. And we're going to put together a New England Revolution package for listeners to, or bidders to, kind of go there, get an MVP experience, VIP, behind the scenes, all this for a match. And the Revs have been great and supportive of this. And when you are part of a family and part of a community, I just think you owe it to everybody to try to help those that are less fortunate and help each other up. And when I was in Boston and Kansas City and Miami, I'm part of those towns. I wanted to do that, and I needed to do that. And you know, I'm just really lucky that those opportunities are afforded to me because I have a microphone. You know, if I'm laying cement or if I'm fixing pipe or if I'm doing insurance, or, you know, maybe those don't come to me. So since they do, I feel like it's my responsibility socially to take advantage of those. And if we helped out along the way, man, it makes it way more worthwhile than just sitting there and talking about, you know, the Patriots secondary for 4 hours, you know?
Yeah, and hopefully some people will hear this, and you'll be able to touch some people the way you have in my career. And we're running up against it here on the Bobcast. It's been the best yet. And before we send you on your way, I slipped my own question into this Bobcast question segment. What advice do you have for me heading off to Syracuse University Wednesday, getting acclimated with the campus there?
I would say, number one, trust your instincts, because Bobby, I've gotten to know you a little bit over the years, and you're going to be real good at this. You're already real good at this. And trust your instincts. You have always been ambitious, and you've tried to take on a lot of projects, and that's the best thing a young broadcaster can do. When you go to Syracuse, doesn't have to be SU. It could be any college. If you're in high school, you want to be a broadcaster, do as much as possible and be open to as much as possible. When I went to Syracuse, I did the sports radio thing at WAER. I also was an FM DJ on Z89 because I wanted reps on the air. I also wrote for the Daily Orange. I also was kind of a student assistant in the PR department. I tried to figure out as many avenues as possible to write, to speak, to do, so that I could figure out what I was good at, what I wanted to do, and that also helped connections throughout my entire career. So be ambitious, do as much as you possibly can, work hard, listen, and don't be afraid to ask for advice, because I think a lot of young broadcasters get intimidated, and they say, oh, that guy's not going to listen to me, or that guy's not going to respond to me. And just like you did, you've reached out to me when you were in high school, an early high schooler, and I was happy to reach back, and I think a lot of broadcasters are. It just takes the gumption to send that email, or to reach out over Facebook, or to reach out over LinkedIn, or whatever it is. And everybody listening to that, to this, that wants to become a sportscaster, or wants to get into broadcasting, or wants to do whatever, don't be afraid to reach out to those people and just ask for advice, because more often than not, you're going to get an answer, and a lot of us want to give back because we were in that position. I remember when I was a young broadcaster, well, I wanted to be when I was in high school, I sent letters upon letters to all these guys that I looked up to, and I just wanted advice. So what would you say? What would you say? And I got tons of letters back. In fact, Bill Peel at ESPN, who I really liked at that time at NFL Primetime and SportsCenter, said, come visit ESPN, and I'll take you to the studio. So I drove up to Bristol, and I got a tour, and that meant the world to me. I didn't think anybody was going to give me a tour. I got a letter from Vin Scully when I was in high school, and that I still hold on to. I still have. When I was at SU, the greatest thing ever was I reached out to all these old SU broadcasters because they were on the Hall of Fame there, you know, whether it was Costas or Marv or Tirico or Sean McDonough, an incredible Boston guy, you know, Dick Stockton, Ian Eagle. And I reached out to so many of them, and so many of them got back to me and would offer advice and would listen to my tape. And that can happen at any school, you know, as long as you're ambitious and you want to connect. So I would just encourage you to follow your instincts and keep asking questions, because people will give you answers, and that's a good thing.
Well, it's been a blessing to have you as a role model in this industry, DEA. I thank you again. Way back when, it must have been 5 years ago, maybe 6 years ago, I reached out to you back when you were here in Boston. And that, the advice you gave me was stuff that stuck with me, and I can really credit you for some of the success I've had early in my career. And thanks so much for being on this platform right here, hopefully one that's going to continue to grow and expand throughout the years. And hopefully your radio show will get more and more of a platform as the years go on, too. And I really appreciate you for coming on, DEA.
My pleasure, Bobby. Keep doing what you're doing. And I appreciate this forum because I don't oftentimes get enough of a chance to thank Boston for what they did to me and for me and help me break my career wide open. And this was a chance to do that. So I appreciate you, man. Thanks so much.
All right. That's DEA of the DEA Show on CBS Sports Radio. Fantastic website, too, while I was researching them today, DamonAmendolara.com. A lot of great tidbits on his story, and it's a story to behold if you want to get into the media. I mean, I'm not saying I've really made my mark yet. I'm so far away from doing that myself, but little projects like this, the Bobcast, all the writing jobs I've done throughout the years, getting active any way I can, Syracuse University, those all came from the advice Damon gave me way back in the day. And I can only thank him over and over and over and over and over again for giving me that advice, responding to me, reaching out to him back in the day. And that really was great advice from him back in the day. Contact those greats in the industry right now. You want to learn from the greats. You want to pull from those guys, and you don't want to totally copy what they do, but you want to have bits and pieces in your arsenal as you try to develop your own personality. And that's something I'm still continuing to do every day on this program. I mean, we get the weekly tour that's slightly inspired by DEA's mothership and a lot of other guys we've had on this program. And through 11 weeks this summer, we've been blessed to have some of the biggest names in the Boston media market, whether it's Chad Finn, Adam Kaufman, DA, who's now in New York. We've had entertainers like Mel Smith who have come on and given his scope and angle of the music industry now through 11 weeks. We've had athletes like Doug Santos who are about to go make their mark on the next level in college football. We've had so many different angles, and just talking to all these different people have really helped me build this circulation of background knowledge on sports, entertainment, media. And that's all it's really all about. Talk to people, reach out to people, do whatever you can to keep going and going and going. And that's what I'm going to continue to do as we hit Syracuse University Wednesday. And I don't know what to expect. I don't know what's going to be coming in the next few weeks. And all I can say is through these 11 weeks, thank you so much for making this summer a productive and expansive one for me and my career. And I hope you're going to continue to stick with the show and my career as we move forward, whether it's with the Daily Orange, Bo Sox Injection, Celtics Blog. And with that, I got to thank all the people who have touched my career in so many ways now. Chris Sanborn, back at the NE Sports Blog. Big shout out to him for getting me started. Nick Hamlin, those guys at Baseball Ascension. Sean McFarland, who we're going to have on the show at some point. They were incredible to me, even though I made a big mistake back then and underrated that experience, but it was something I learned from. Paul Swettelson, Sam Bloom, all those guys at the Daily Orange for getting me acclimated as I start that next step in my career next week. Those guys helped me out so much with getting acclimated to Syracuse and the newspaper there. Mark Vanderson, the whole JR, all those guys at CelticsLife.com. That was where I really started to expand myself as a writer. Rob Sullivan, the Tanner Times, all the people who worked with me there. Nick McLaughlin taking it over next year. That experience was unlike having control of that and making my own was one of the best experiences in high school. Mark Bencourt, Doug Santos, the whole entire junior and senior year 2014-2015 Peabody football teams, thank you for embracing my coverage back then. All the Peabody team for opening up to me as I try to do coverage of as many teams as I could there. Jeff Clark, Kevin O'Connor, who's starting at the Ringer now, and a fantastic opportunity for him. Thank you for welcoming me, giving me that platform at Celtics Blog. Sean Penny over at Bo Sox Injection, where I'm going to get started this week. I mean, on and on and on. My parents are supporting me throughout this career. Wouldn't have been possible without their support, both loving and financially. Wouldn't be anywhere close to where I am right now. Going to Syracuse University, it's been such a blessing having them. And above all, CLNS Radio, Larry H. Russell, Nick Gelso, Justin Poole, and John Duke, thank you guys so much for welcoming the Bobcast, giving an 18-year-old a chance to have his own show on your esteemed network. You guys have meant so much to me in building this show, building this brand throughout the summer. Nick Gelso, above all, for giving me the chance to do this. Celtics Post Game Live, all the people I worked with there throughout the last few months. It's amazing how many locations I've been in over the last years. And above all, above anything else, you guys listening to me, reading my things. It hasn't been the best content I can deliver so far, but it's only going to get better and better and better. And like DA did, I hope to form a product one day that you guys really enjoy. So you want to continue to follow the journey. You want to continue to follow the developments in my life. RealBobManning.com, launching in September, a portfolio, and the Journey Blog. That's what it's going to be called, the Journey Blog. We're getting that started. We're going to launch that out in Syracuse, and we're going to absolutely bloom out there. Dan Scott, we're coming for you, my roommate. We're getting started Wednesday. And thank you all so much for being with the Bobcast these last 11 weeks. We're taking a week off this next week as we get acclimated to the campus. We move all my stuff in. I get started with the Daily Orange there. But we are back with some great guests come September. Sean McFarland, Baseball Essential, going to be joining our show. And Pat Rotolo, the Peabody High legend, who is going to be now, who has been pitching in the Giants organization for a couple months now. He's starting his Major League Baseball career right from the bottom, and we're going to talk to him about the long journey it's been for him. Thank you, thank you, thank you again. And we are off from Boston to Syracuse starting now. We'll see you in New York in 2 weeks. And for now, enjoy the Olympics. Enjoy football season starting up. Enjoy your baseball team if they're not infuriating you like mine is. And with that, peace.